Hello, this is the RTE Rugby Podcast. Thanks for dropping in. We're available on Spotify, iTunes, all the places where you usually get your podcasts. Today, one of the game's most positive and popular people, Ian Keatley, joins us in studio. RTE's online chief, Mikey Stafford, and we have against the head and now Sunday game producer, Wes Liddy, fresh from his kung fu exercise last night. We might talk about that in a minute. We want to get going with what I can't get really my head around. Major rugby news. We have the whole Folau thing still bubbling, and we'll have to reference that. But there's two quarterfinals on, or effectively, this weekend in the Pro 14, and it's very quiet.
It is quite quiet. I think it's quiet because we haven't had a very massively meaningful interprovincial or Pro 14 game for a couple of weeks. So it does seem a little bit quiet, which is why I'm harking back to Monday for one of our stories, which I think is interesting. In that Johan van Gran had to come out and confirmed that Conor Murray would train this week and is fit, but also, you know, he had no concerns about how Munster are warming up for games after a few pre-match injuries this season. But I think it was the reaction to Murray not starting was telling in this supposed age of GDPR and players' medical records being their own, etc., and Conor Murray's injury going a little bit unexplained in the first part of the season. Conor Murray, you know, not starting a game and holding his neck led to massive speculation around his fitness and stories claiming he was a World Cup out, etc. It just goes to show that in a vacuum, you know, all sorts can happen.
I can't see any reason why a player would bow to any sort of media pressure to release their medical data, for the simple reason, and this isn't even an ethical one, is if you go to a doctor, Mikey and Wes, if you go to a doctor and you've something wrong with you, he usually gives you a kind of a vague answer. He says, yeah, I think we're going to investigate that, or we're going to that. So do you come out every time and say, well, they're not 100% sure, but they're looking? I mean, you surely have no obligation to do
no,
that.
No, of course you don't. No, I'm not claiming the right or the wrong, but it's the situation has changed. We've got to the point where we have coaches claiming players aren't playing because of general tightness. You know, it's kind of gone. Sure. It's gone to an extreme now, and we in the media, if things are left unexplained, we'll find an explanation. So
we need to have a good hard look at ourselves.
Yeah, there's no judgment here. I just thought it was the reaction to Murray going off, possibly holding his neck, was telling, because, you know, he hadn't played for, not unexplained. You know, he explained it in the end, but there was such a furore around his unexplained absence at the start of the season that his absence from a end of season Pro 14 game was amplified tellingly, I thought.
Well, it's been a bit of a spectre since what, July, August last year, I remember
2011, one of Paul O'Connell's first games back, him picking up a knock towards the end of a game, and it was against Leinster actually in Thomond Park, and it was immediate World Cup on the horizon stuff as well. I suppose it's just human nature. No one mentioned poor Dan Goggin, who had to get a HIA after the incident, as far as I know. But, yeah, I don't know. I'd imagine if you have a full medical staff there and people are, you know, monitoring these players every day of the week, that to kind of have to come out and defend your warm-up practices to completely uninformed speculation, I could see why it would, be an irritant, at least to the likes of Johan van Gran.
But like, as intractable issues go in the interface between media and professional sport, I mean, surely that they can get together and say, look, we are just not going to address any speculation. These are a person's private medical records. And the practical reason is, as I said, if I go with chest pains to the doctor isn't going to immediately tell me I'm fine or I'm going to die. He's going to give me an answer in the middle. So all you can do is parrot back.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, because when there's nothing, then speculation starts. Not necessarily amongst the media, but effectively there's another media now via various social networks, and that's where, and you know, Ian will know a lot about this because it's happened in Munster a few times, but it's where rumours and all the rest start. And I suppose, you know, the teams get annoyed with the rumour mill, yet the rumour mill is largely prompted in a roundabout way because there's nothing concrete to give. But you know, what you're saying is valid too. It's, I don't know. It's just one of those things, really,
doctors
isn't it?
Doctors are famous for not sticking their neck on the block. They will give you an ambiguous answer. And I take issue with your another media point, Wes. I mean, it is. It's all one big splodge now.
Yeah,
it?
But there's, you know, the more damaging things that emerge are the product of supporters in inverted commas on social media. There's not legitimate mainstream journalists, positing theories about this stuff on a weekly basis, I don't think.
Yeah, Ian, what is it about the obsession with injury? I mean, do you throw your eyes up to heaven whether it's you or another player that's the subject of all these ill-informed medical analysis from the doctors on the fence?
Well, just being involved in professional sport, I 100% know that the doctors and the physios are 100% behind the players, and if they don't think you're fully right for a match, they won't put you on, and that's what you want from a player, is that you know that no matter what, maybe a coach is trying to put pressure on you to play, but you know that the backroom staff 100% are behind you, and that's what you want to feel from a backroom staff. And the other point, once you don't disclose an injury, it was said already, like those gaps get filled by unexplained. Like I've heard that Conor Murray was out for a banned substance because he wasn't playing. So someone just made that up. And then that's how the rumour mill starts, which I can completely see why Conor and any other player want.
It's a lie.
Yeah, it's a blatant lie, but it just get the, if you don't answer the question, it just gets filled with lies. But then again, if Conor, let's say Conor had like a knee injury and he didn't want to disclose that, because you never know, an opposition knows that he might have a knee injury, he's going to take a box kick, and then the opposition might just, they know that he might have a bad knee, might start attacking that knee, and that's why players sometimes don't want to disclose about their injuries, because they know they might get targeted a bit more. And as you said, if you go to a normal doctor, you don't come out and have to tell the world what's wrong with you. So it's private, it's a contact sport, there's going to be injuries, there's going to be niggles, and you shouldn't have to disclose that.
Ian, when you mentioned that, when those rumours about Conor Murray, for example, that we'd all heard that were ridiculous, but when you're inside the camp, do players kind of lump the media together with those, wherever those rumours are coming from? Or in this day and age, are people well aware that, you know, the source of some things are from anonymous people online that have nothing to do with the game on a daily basis?
It's a little bit, when you're in that environment, you obviously know what's going on, you know what's wrong with players, you know if guys have picked up injuries or niggles, or if there's problems at home. So when you do see rumours on social media, it's kind of just laughed about, really, because we just know that, I'd say 95% of it's just a rumour. So you kind of do wonder where it all starts, but I suppose that's modern day social media. And
yeah, if you engage in it, you're finished anyway. And if you come back and say you're talking through your hole,
it's Eddie O'Sullivan's fault that disastrous World Cup prompted this new trend in Irish rugby, that everyone started speculating about everything
because we never found the body, was it?
Yeah,
12 years on,
But on the flip side, you have to respect that other people have jobs and careers, and it's probably a bit of a part of their job and career is to create conversation and speculation and just to get people talking. So I can see that side of it too, but just sometimes it does go a little bit too far, and you have to remember that there's two sides to every story, and it can affect family members, and like it mightn't affect the player as much, but it might affect family members, and like even I know I've got a few rumors spread about me, and it affects your family. And even
what was
like,
your favorite one?
Oh god, I've had too many to count. So
but about your health or about your private life or what? I'm not looking for details because they're not worth repeating, I'd imagine, from your tone, you know?
Mine is just more so on the rugby field, so it wasn't too bad. It never escalated onto my private life, thankfully.
Were you not that exciting off the pitch then?
No.
Yeah, and come here, you're busy at the moment, aren't you? I mean, in terms of geographical change and life change and leasing yourself, you have a baby now and all the rest of it, so you're kind of, you're rebooting for your 30s.
Yeah, well, I'm 32 now, and yeah, we're starting to get prepared for a move to Italy in the summer. I'm just literally finished a stint in London Irish there with Declan Kidney and Les Kiz. So
tell us about that. It's great. I mean, it worked out really well, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think obviously, unfortunately for Stephen Myler, he picked up an injury, and they were looking for a backup cover, and I wasn't playing too much at Munster, and Declan Kidney got on to Philip Quinn, the CEO of the standing CEO of Munster, and said, "Listen, are you? Do you need Ian? We'd love to have him over here." And it all happened so quickly, and I ended up moving over to London Irish for 3 months. I didn't bring the family because obviously we're moving to Italy, so I didn't want to uproot them and then bring them back and then go again. So I think with my time in London Irish, it was pretty much 3 months, played around 9 or 10 games and helped them get promoted. And now officially I'm currently I'm finished at London Irish, so I'm actually unemployed.
Until I
move to Treviso. So I think a few people were asking me, am I going to go on the Dáil Éireann? But
that's the latest rumor. Now it's going to start.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you're out of contract technically until when? June 1st, July 1st.
I commence with Treviso on July 15th. So okay, I think the next few weeks are going to be spent preparing for that and preparing for the move. I don't think it's easy as just get in your car and drive across. There's a lot of planning going involved in moving to Treviso. So, but it's such an exciting time for myself and my family. And
yeah, exactly. I mean, this is it, isn't it? I mean, like from London and Galway and Limerick to something completely different.
Exactly. Yeah, not many. You can't say too many times in your life can you move to another country, doing something that you love, getting paid for it, and just learning a new culture and a new language for 2 years in your life at least.
Yeah, and to me now, again, and I don't claim to know you intimately, but I've bumped into you down the road, and you seem to be a positive person. It's not you're not contriving this. You look at things, you're a glass half full man.
But I've gone through the other side of it as well, and I think I've just, through experience and through my times in rugby, I think I've learned just to take the positives out of it, because I think I realised in rugby that you're only one game away from it being on the other side of thinking the other way. So and then I've had my cousin passed away 2 years ago through mental health issues, and I think that's just been another eye opener for me. And
it's too much of it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And when you realise how short life is, and I know a lot of players get so down about their own performance, and now it's kind of heaped on with social media that if you have a bad game, a player knows that he has a bad game, but then it's heaped on by social media and media. So I think I try and do take a more positive look now, because I know how it does affect players when they have a bad game or a poor performance, and obviously from external people as well. Like, I know how hard life is, so you just kind of have to try and look at the positives, because you only get one shot at this.
Yeah, interesting, because like, it's a shame. There was a kind of an unspoken code of conduct between players in their off time and on the pitch, and that seems to have gone out now. You have to be, I suppose, if in doubt, you just are overly cautious with your dealings with media, public, whatever. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, it is, but you do. You do kind of wish you had your private life, but then again, with social media and players are on social media, you have to remember you are role models. People look up to you, and once you put something out on social media, people look at that and view that, and you do have to be careful what you say. But
Well, there's no room for grey areas. I was just thinking this, and we're just touching it briefly, because we saw the tweet that, you know, the Falau tweet, and it's still rambling on. And I mean, it's like, there's two cultural wrongs clashing here. There's discrimination against LGBT people, and then there's a certain amount of kind of scorn of an ethnic minority, I suppose, religious beliefs. So who wins? And we've come down to a kind of a binary solution here. Telling gay people they're going to hell is wrong. Everyone accepts that. But telling religious people that their beliefs are odious without any qualification is a dodgy one as well. So I don't know. Where is the grey area in which most human life is lived here? It's a very, very binary debating forum, social media. It's you're either with us or against us. I mean, Mikey, can I bring you in this, because you work in digital media?
Yeah, we've been chatting a bit about this, as Wes says, it seems like we've all been chatting about this for an age now. A couple of points. Firstly, if you live your life by the Old Testament, it's going to be a very short and very lonely life. So I think that's the first point I would make on it. But on that, I do come down on the what you think is a bit of a cop-out, the employment law side of things here. But we work for RTE. We all would have been told in the last week or two, there's an election coming up. We don't want you on social media or on air to, you know, show any support or opposition for any party candidate in the upcoming local elections and European elections. For local elections, that's not a big issue for any staff, but I would think for the last two referendums, the marriage rights and abortion referendum, I'd say a lot of RTE staff would have found it very difficult to follow those regulations. But the fact is, it's in your terms of your employment. You have to obey this because it comes with the territory of being an RTE. So I do think, while I also agree that Israel Folau's views are odious, they're his religious views, and if he holds them in private, grand, and even, you know, not so much private, but his personal life. But he does have a responsibility as somebody with as many followers as he has on Instagram. And to do it once, grand, but he's been warned by his employers and he's done it again and he knows the impact of it. So I have very little sympathy for him, while I do take on board your point about Christianity, etc. There's lots of examples of Christian athletes. We have one close to home in Katie Taylor. Don't know what her views are on LGBT, but hers is a positive measure. Even Bubba Watson, who strikes me as deeply religious, and a survey was done a few years ago and he came out as the PGA Tour golfer most golfers would like to punch the most. They had a confidential survey, and he came out well on top of that. So he's obviously
another
got views.
Example of the temperate climate we live in.
And you know, Tim Tebow was like a very high draft prospect in the NFL. Didn't do particularly well at Denver, but one of the reasons he didn't do well is because people gravely disliked him because he was overtly religious.
I don't think anyone's rehashing the debate insofar as who's right and wrong. I think it's been made pretty clear what side everyone came down on there. But I did think at the time, but probably been honest for slight hesitancy for saying anything that wasn't completely rowing in the direction of the prevailing mood at the time. I did think there was a couple of alarm bells with this because, I mean, we've thrown this stat out there a few times, but in the last World Cup, 30% of the players total were Polynesian. A lot of them are more, in the truest sense of the word, God-fearing in their approach to religion than we are. If we want to make this about employment law, which, like, we all know it isn't, you can't tell 30% of your workforce what to think.
But you can tell them to be quiet because it contravenes a corporate morality.
You can... But we've seen what's happened this morning in Australia with Polynesian players threatening mutiny, was the quote. I don't know how realistic that is.
Probably not that realistic.
But, you know, you are talking about a group of people, just in a purely rugby sense, whose, you know, players are stolen. There's a new World League starting. They're not involved. Now even their most private beliefs are being questioned. I mean, I can understand why they would feel a little marginalised within the context of rugby as well.
Yes.
And it would seem throughout history, any group in any walk of life who've been told to shut up have rarely done so. They've, if anything, become more entrenched in their views. So, I mean, if this was or will possibly become an ongoing issue, surely it seems some kind of forum is the only way forward. Like, I'm making this up, but, you know, Garrett Thomas, Nigel Owens, Billy Vunipola get in a room somewhere. That might be a ridiculous notion.
Allowing their thoughts to breathe.
But
yeah, fair enough. Ian, can you tell us, not in this one, because we are going to move on, but in general, like this, as Mikey was referring to, your employer now really has guardianship over your public pronouncements. And in rugby, I presume it's the same. I mean, is there some guidance given to you in Munster, now that you've left? You can tell us a bit about, like, what not to say. It hasn't become an issue as far as I know. But, I mean, are there guidelines for you guys in social media?
Yeah, I think there used to be a rule that you weren't allowed to tweet or anything like that 24 hours and after a game. But I think it's kind of moved to more of a...
Political.
Yeah, more common sense, really. Just, okay. But then again, my mum always says there's nothing common about common sense. So, but I think... there has to be a common sense, and I do agree that people have to express their beliefs. As I said already, they are role models, and you have to stand up for what you believe in. But there is a way of doing it, and that's where I think common sense comes back in. And it's a tough subject to talk about, but I just think it just looks to me, as he's been warned a few times already, and then to come out really hit home about it, there must be another underlying current, because I don't think any player, if he got warned two or three times already, would come out and be, he kind of, his beliefs, I firmly agree with what he wants to preach, but there is a way of doing things, and he kind of came across very aggressively in doing it.
You know what we can do? We can make our minds up that on one of the RT Rugby podcasts, we will actually have a proper exploration of Polynesian culture, because, you know, we tend to consider it as just a monoculture. There's a whole lot of nuance in their own culture as well. I mean, it is problematic, but we'll kick on. September 2008, Ian Keighley makes his debut for Connacht the day after Kevin Keegan is fired from his second spell in charge of Newcastle. Does that make you feel young or old?
Very old.
It is a while back, isn't it?
Yeah. Kevin Keegan, Jane.
Yeah, I know. You know, I used to do the matches in Setanta back in those days. And I remember, again, you're probably not even close friends, but yourself and Fionn Carr were the two guys who kind of came on the scene at the same time. And it does seem like a different era.
Yeah, I think that was my first match, Ospreys. I think it might have been Ospreys at home.
Yes. And then because I remember you kicked a whole hatful in your second game, was it?
I can't remember the second game. But yeah, I think it was myself, Fionn Carr, and Sean Cronin joined Connacht at the same time. And we actually ended up living together. What is that now, 11 years later?
Sure.
It's been a great career, and I'm just blessed that I got to play with Connacht, I got to play with Munster, I was in the Leinster setup, and now moving to Treviso, I'm just so blessed. I remember when I first started off, I was like, if I'm able to do this for 10 years, I'd be so grateful, because I think the average career of a rugby player is only, I think it's between 6 and 7 years through injury and not getting employed again. So to have 10 years, or to have 11 years now, moving on to hopefully 13, I'm pretty blessed to be playing still.
2-year deal with Treviso.
Yeah, 2-year deal with Treviso. So it's exciting, and I'm trying to, when I went over to London Irish there, I tried to start my Italian
Duolingo.
I've gotten better. I just can't speak it. It's like when I go and try and speak it, I start thinking French, Irish, everything but Italian. So I'll get there once I'm immersed in it. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, this is it. Life is an adventure again, I suppose, after being pretty samey for the last few years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, with Munster, I had so many ups and downs. But I loved literally every single moment of it. And I made such good memories, such good friends. And I think I really, as I went to Munster when I was 23, 24, and where I've come, since I moved to Limerick, I have a partner, we're getting married, and I've got a kid now, so my life has completely changed when I've gone to Munster, and I've just grown up as a person, and it's kind of made me the person who I am today. And I'm just looking forward to the next adventure and moving to Italy, trying to learn new language, new culture. It's just an exciting time, and I'm just thankful that I'm able to do it, and I know my parents are going to be over, my family's going to come over and visit, and all my friends, so it's going to change their lives too.
Yeah, 7 caps for Ireland. I mean, where did it all start? Where did you grow up, Ian? Excuse me.
Well, I was born in Dublin, so I went to Belvedere School, Belvedere College, in school, when I started there when I was 9 until I was 18, so I did 10 years there.
You're a Northsider, are you?
Yeah, I'm from Howth. So are you from Malahide?
No, I lived there for a while. I'm from Cork, but thanks for giving me the
you lived there for a while. Yeah.
I did, yeah. I adopted some of the customs of the natives.
And then so I went to Belvedere, so I was the last junior school that went through Belvedere. They don't actually have a junior school now, so I was literally the last class. So when I was in third class, went to fourth class, there was no third class. when I went to fifth, there was no fourth, so it was literally the last one.
Being chased.
Yeah, being chased the whole way. Did there for 10 years, and then I did 2 years in UCD, where I played under 20s, and then a year with the first, and then I moved to Clontarf. I did 1 year in Clontarf, and then I obviously had played Ireland under 20s with Eric Elwood and Dan McFarlane as my coaches.
Right.
And they were involved in Connacht, and they asked me would I be interested in moving to Connacht. And I'd spent 2 years in Leinster Academy, and I saw that like Fionn Carr had done 3 years and he wasn't being kept on. And then, so I kind of got a bit of a fear, if that way, is that if I did another year in Leinster that I mightn't be kept on. So
disappear,
I tried.
Yeah.
Yeah, you never know. I just know they had signed Issa Nasiwa at that time as a number 10. I know he played mainly fullback and
yeah, I remember his first couple of games at 10.
Yeah, yeah. They signed him as a 10, and then they had Johnny Sexton and Felipe Contabomi was still there at the time. So I just had to try and weigh it up, and I just thought that maybe moving to Connacht would be a better choice to try and get game time and further my career. And did 3 years there, and then Munster came looking for me, saying would I be interested in joining Munster, and so did Leinster. They were saying would you be interested in coming to Leinster, back to Leinster again. But I kind of weighed it up, and obviously Johnny Sexton was there, and I knew that Ronan O'Gara was later on in his career, and I just thought it'd be good to sit behind Ronan for a year or two, try and learn off him, and then hopefully push, or if he had retired, that I'd get an opportunity then. And just lo and behold, it kind of worked out that way.
Did you get on well yourself and Rog?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, see, he was based in Cork and I was based in Limerick, and I think we did get on. I wouldn't say we were friends or anything like that. I think.
Was he critical of you?
I wouldn't say critical, but I kind of.
It's just his body language, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I just kind of sat back and learned from him rather than him actually going through games with me or talking, or I'd just sit back and listen to him when he talked in front of the group. Mm. So I kind of learned more so that way. I wouldn't say he put an arm over my shoulder or anything like that. Mm. But just watching him, the way he went about and just his tactical kick, and I kind of learned a lot from that, because I was more so seen as a running out half.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to try to learn kind of more the Munster way, the tactical kicking, and then I kind of almost went too much. I actually got renowned for a bit more of a tactical kicker than a running out half, which was strange enough, because I was always seen as a running out half. So
what's your favourite part of your own game, looking back, and your least favourite? I mean, you know, mentality, physicality, handling, field position, goal kicking. What's your favourite part of your own game, being as neutral as you can be, and what's your least favourite?
I think I've played a good few positions. So I've played 9 a few, stepped in at 9 a few games, 10, played 12, played 13, played fullback, and then I've had 5 minutes on the wing as an international winger. Coming on against Italy in the Six Nations, but I think my durability, because I never really got injury, and my versatility. So I always found when I actually played other positions like 13 or fullback that it helped me when I went back into number 10, that I was like, okay, maybe I can just give the ball a bit earlier, give the guys a bit more time and space, because I know when I played there I just wanted the ball a bit earlier, or I saw the game a little bit differently. So I just found when I changed position, it just helped my
empathy for your teammates, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Yeah,
no problem, anytime. But come here, as Wes, as a Limerick man, you were saying to me there that you were taken with Ian's adoption of your native county as his home.
No, I remember you were doing the backs coach with Joe Munsters for a while, were you?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I did it for 2.5 years, pretty much.
And that was, so Ger Slattery was forwards, and you'd played together back in 2007, the Grand Slam winning team?
Yeah, we were on the Ireland Under 20s Grand Slam winning team. Yeah, I was with Ger and Keith Earls and Tommy O'Donnell and the likes of that. So there's a good few Munster players there.
And do you think has the culture in Munster changed since you first joined up until now, or is it still the same?
Yeah, there's quite a few bits that are still the same, but I think Munster's kind of the biggest problem over the last few years. I think they've had nearly 5 head coaches now, obviously through obviously results and obviously the passing of Anthony. But yeah, there's just been five different head coaches, and I just think a bit more stability might just help a little bit. And we talk about culture. Yeah, culture is found when you step into a place, you should be able to feel the culture. But also, when you get such a change in coaches, they have their own beliefs, and obviously every player is trying to look up to the coach and trying to give the coach what they want. So when a new coach comes in with different beliefs, the culture does get affected a little bit. So I think it has changed a little bit, but there is still that. I think it's still the old Munster is still there, and it's probably more so reached by the fans and what the people. When you go to a match and you can really feel it from the fans, what it means to them, and I think that will never die anyway.
You mentioned your durability. You were talking physically, but I think kind of mentally it showed a lot as well, because you were great at bouncing back from bad performances. I remember I saw you actually. I was at the match in Gloucester when you starred in a Heineken pool match. I think it was 27 in the end back in 2014. But the week before you'd had, by your own admission, a bit of a horror show up in Raven Hill. And I think you told us afterwards that you'd gone out in a driving range and smacked golf balls for an afternoon, and you kind of made you feel better about yourself. And then Rob Penny told you you'd be playing the next week, and so you were grand. But it does seem to have been, it has to be a feature of because not every match can be fantastic, and the focus on Munster teams, and a Munster team that was perhaps on the wane from the glory days, it probably wasn't always the easiest place to be the number 10 in the shadow of Rog and everything else.
And it was on the wane.
Yeah, definitely. I kind of wish it probably wasn't what I'd be remembered for, the durability of bouncing back after poor performances. But listen, I never intended to have a bad performance. I never wanted to play poorly. And I think the reason I got so upset after games when I didn't play well is because you know how many people, like, yeah, it's, you hurt yourself, your own personally, but you know that you let a lot of people down. You obviously let the fans down, you let the other players and the coaches down, and you just, a player never wants to do that. A player always wants to go out and put his best foot forward, and it was never through lack of preparation or training. I think a few people said to me, oh, do you never, like, via social media, do you never, like, practice your place kicking? And it couldn't have been more the opposite. I almost found that I practiced too much, that I was, like, driving myself nuts by practicing, because I couldn't figure it out sometimes. And even no matter how hard I tried or how hard I trained, that I'd get my timing back and I'd get a rhythm going, and then all of a sudden it would just, my kicks wouldn't go over. And
As a supporter, that's one of the reasons I admired your durability, as you put it yourself, because you could actually read on your face the pain and the agony if your kicking wasn't working, that you had to just find a nerveless place. what kind of tells or tricks did you use just to get into the zone where you were, the heartbeat was regular and you weren't coursing with adrenaline, and that you were just following the routine?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think you just have to follow a routine, and I think sometimes I was following a routine even though I was like, oh no. Like, you would be there standing over a kick and you'd do all your normal routine, and I'd be looking at the ball when times are going bad, and I was like, oh my God, it's like I've never been in this position before. Even though I had kicked so many, like, I think it was Munster's second top point scorer, and I was Connacht's top point scorer for a while there before I think Jack Carty took over a few matches ago. And I was like, I had to go back to that place going, like, I think my dad always reminded me, goes, like, Ian, like, you've done so much, like, just look at these. And he just, like, reassure me that, like, you're still a good player no matter how bad your performance was. I think that was, I think the funny thing was, a lot of my performances when I kicked poorly, I actually played well in the game or defended well or attacked well, but I think I was mostly remembered for poor kicking. And I think that's frustrating, because I go back, look at the game, and I was like, oh, I actually played all right. But it's just, sometimes it's weird when you have a poor kicking game that can just overshadow all the other good things that you did. So
Yes, I suppose in fairness, the number 10 stock in trade is kind of the 90-95% or wherever you can get to with the place boot. But people forget your contributions there as well. I mean, a winning drop goal versus Sale. Was it versus Sale back around the time Mikey was talking about? And Fiji, I remember that match because I think we were there. And you had two kicks. We could have got beaten by Fiji that day. They weren't the most difficult kicks, but you threw them over nervelessly and Ireland won 23-20.
Definitely. And I think when you get shown, I think before I left to go to London Irish, they put up a few clips of me, my performance with Munster. And yeah, I think the Sale one was a great drop goal, but I'd won a few games with last minute kicks and stuff like that. So it was kind of nice seeing all them and nice to remember all those good memories I've had and the winning kicks. And I think when I look back and I go, yeah, I think I won Munster more games than I lost them, but it's just unfortunate that those ones that you lost just kind of come back to haunt you. But as I said before, it's made me a stronger person, a better person, and I think I've become more of a positive person outside of rugby just from what's happened on the field.
Just to go back into moving provinces twice. And yeah. I mean, there's a small bit of talk now of, you know, especially when it comes to Munster, I suppose, that maybe, you know, it's almost a 50-50 split between kind of players that have come up through the local route and players from, you know, the four corners. But I suppose there's a little bit of a fear or a curiosity in Ireland about, you know, will the other three provinces end up being made up of people who, for one reason or another, haven't stuck around in Leinster? Is, while we all think it's good for the national team that people get game time, is there any fear from a purely provincial point of view that there can be too much of that you can lose something intrinsic to the province you're at? I mean, what would be your thoughts on that whole issue of movement between the provinces?
Well, you kind of have that double-edged sword again. I think a lot of people who have that opinion of there's too many other provinces playing on your team, yeah, are probably the same people who are wanting results quick and fast. I think probably the Leinster Academy is probably a good few years ahead of all the other academies, just because purely because of the probably the school system. And I know talking to a lot of younger players who went to Belvedere or Michaels, they say that their schools have now become almost like mini academies. So once they've come actually through the schools and they step into an academy platform, they're already light years ahead. I remember when I first went into the academy, I only had probably 1 year's training of strength and conditioning and nutrition. Well, now it's just it's the norm, and players are coming through who are fully developed, nutrition's perfected on, and now all they're honing in on is their skills. And I probably think that's probably where the other provinces are probably slacking a little bit. It's not true lack of effort, but I think the players need to be from an earlier age probably brought through that system a bit quicker. Yeah. And then I think that's when, but as I said, it's people are looking for results quick and fast, and that puts pressure on provinces to bring players in, and that's where they probably look to other provinces. But I think if they're more patient, I think there is good structures in place, and I think in a few years there is good players coming through, like Craig Casey and Sean French. They've all come through that system, so they'll be coming up, and I think if we're a bit more patient, the players will come through.
Yeah, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of invested in an academy player that, you know, comes from, and I won't name the schools because I'm not having a go at anyone but any of the Leinster schools. But we see it too. Like, there's 50-something players. Mark McKenna works with us here, was telling me 54, 56 players have played for Leinster this year. It's an awful lot, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they can rotate it by choice a bit
but
more
that,
as well.
That's like, I always remember thinking 40 would be a big number to hit during the course of a season, wouldn't
well,
it?
Well, you've traditionally 6 A schools in Munster. You've 16 in Leinster, so yeah. I mean, and like, if you leave Glenstall out of it, Present Christians are private schools, but they're private schools that it costs $3,000 a year to go to.
4.5 now.
You know, it's 15, 16 in some of their contemporaries. So when you produce that kind of revenue, that money pays directors of rugby, strength and conditioning coaches, team get, you know, we saw two teams going to Spain last summer for warm weather training, schools teams. Yeah. So you can say numbers or you can say infrastructure. The fact is
economics.
It's both. And I sometimes feel bad for Munster and some of the other academies and the way that they're perceived, or this line is trotted out about how much better Leinster's academy is. Mm. And obviously it is on the surface, but it's actually quite a hard thing to measure. Is success the percentage of players that are intaken that eventually end up playing senior rugby? In which case, there's probably a bigger spill-off in Leinster as well. So it's very difficult. If they're all doing their business to maximum efficiency, it's right that Leinster will produce more players. So it's kind of one that's difficult to beat people about too much, you know.
For sure. Ian, before we let you go, we'll just get you to gig for us as a pundit. Now, here's a nice one for you. Munster versus Benetton this Saturday.
Do I have to answer that question?
Do, because your Italian is so shocking, as you were saying yourself, that it'll not be translated.
We have a massive following in Italy as well.
Treviso have come leaps and bounds, and I think a few years ago people would have thought that Connacht would have got to the final and won, so I think Treviso have got a very good chance, but I just think Munster at home in Thomond Park, and now they've only got one cup to concentrate on.
And a game to Leinster as a carrot. And at home, I think.
At home, yeah. But I think whoever wins the first 20 minutes will go on and win that match.
Tell me Ulster-Connacht then. That's a fascinating one. Winner away to Glasgow.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? Because Connacht are the only team to have beaten Ulster up there. Ulster have been unbeaten up there all season.
Which
apart
they
from
couldn't
Connacht.
Do since the 50s or the 60s for years.
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? It's going to be such a good game. That's a tough one, because
at home you'd give it to Connacht, but in Belfast you're giving it to Ulster.
Yeah, I just think home advantage is so key in these games. It's very rare that you see an away win, but I think Ulster are in, but I hope Connacht I hope Connacht can cause an upset. But
and finally then the big one, as a Setonians man, Cork Conn versus Clontarf. We're showing that for you on Sunday on RTE2, the AIL final. Now you have a Clontarf connection as well, and it's a lovely matchup. I mean, I won't go and say it's Saracens versus Leinster, but in the Irish club context, it is probably the right two teams. Lansdowne might object to that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think Cork Conn and Clontarf have been the most consistent teams over the last couple of years in the AIL. Honestly, I'm torn that, because I know James Downey and he's working with Clontarf. I'm gonna go with that.
Very good. Well, listen.
What about Johnny Holland there at Cork Conn, another former teammate?
Yeah, James Downey, I still keep in touch with. So
I see Johnny's one of our own. He's our rugby columnist, so I'm afraid I'm in the other camp.
Okay.
He's fallen off your WhatsApp list, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. Listen, we really, really look forward to seeing you in the league again next year, and this time in the green and white stripes.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm looking forward to it, and hopefully I can get into a studio over in Italy and chat again to you when I'm over there.
Well, I'd be delighted if you make the effort. We'd appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to speak to you, and enjoy your honesty and your recollections, and to take part in your good fortune, as you said, and you admit, of having had such a wonderful career in terms of injury. And we wish you another 2 years minimum. So thank you, Ian Keighley.
Okay. Thanks, Dara. Thanks, Wes. Thanks,
Cheers.
Michael. See you guys.
Take care, Ian. Okay, well, that's about it. Anyone got anything to add before we wrap up for the week? What about anything else bugging you over there, Mikey?
Well, just to mention, Jack Carty came up there as the man to surpass Ian in the Connacht scoring charts. He's been nominated for the Players' Player of the Year alongside Tadhg Byrne, Peter O'Mahony, and James Ryan. So,
which awards are these? These the IRUPA?
Players. Probably the more prestigious one, I guess, at this point.
Right.
Voted for by your peers and all that.
Yeah.
And you've Anna Capeless, Emer Constein, and Kira Griffin have been nominated for the Women's 15s Award.
Wes, thank you. Mikey, thank you.
No problem. Mm-hmm.
Ian, thank you. And we'll leave it there. We'll talk to you next week. Go easy.